I'm Joel Scandrett, professor of historical theology here at Trinity School for Ministry and director of the Robert Weber Center, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this lecture. Many of you have been a part of this conference, but this is also an open public lecture, so welcome to those of you who are not a part of the conference but are attending the lecture. One of the most vital questions of our day for the church is, what does it mean to be human? This is the topic of this year's conference, and we've plunged deep already today and will continue to do so tomorrow. To help us consider a Christian response to this question, we're fortunate to have as our keynote speaker this evening Dr. Mark Cortez. Dr. Cortez is a professor of theology at Wheaton College and a leading theologian in the area of theological anthropology, the Christian understanding of human nature. He's the author of many articles and books on this subject, including Resourcing Theological Anthropology, Christological Anthropology and Historical Perspective, and Theological Anthropology, A Guide for the Perplexed. He travels, speaks, and teaches widely, and he's been on campus this week teaching our conference course on this subject. And we highly recommend his work for you for further reading on this important topic. Mark will be signing books in the bookstore immediately following the conclusion of the session. We'll be having a time of Q&A at the end, but undoubtedly you may also have questions that you can ask him then. Mark's talk tonight is entitled Being Human in a Dehumanizing World, the Image of God and Christian Anthropology. Mark, it's a delight to welcome you to Trinity.
All right, well, thank you all for being here this evening, particularly those of you who apparently are sufficiently desperate that you're actually coming to hear me speak for the second time today. Before I jump into the paper itself, kind of a little autobiographical reflection on the paper. So Mark Twain's got a fabulous short story where he's kind of telling the story of this protagonist, and the protagonist keeps getting kind of mired deeper and deeper into this difficult situation. And he gets to the end of his short story, and then he steps in as the author, and he's like, you know what? I've gotten my protagonist into a situation that I can't figure out how to get him out of, so I'm done. And that's the end of the short story. That story came to mind as I was working on this paper. Because I did realize partway through that I was raising a series of questions, and that it's just one of those papers that you get into and you're realizing, I think I've begun asking questions that I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to answer by the time I'm done with the paper. So you'll have homework after this paper, which will be to figure out how to answer any questions that I left unresolved, which I kind of fear might be most of them, but we'll see how that goes. Now, I have to admit that I sometimes feel a bit out of place in this modern world. I love words. I grew up on books. I write books. I routinely sit at desks and tables surrounded by stacks of books. I also talk a lot, in classes, at conferences like this, and when I have to, even at social gatherings. I love a well-crafted sentence and those authors who seem to turn them out so effortlessly, though I appreciate how much work it actually took to find the right phrase, the fitting cadence. That evocative metaphor slips so neatly and unexpectedly into the surrounding prose. My life is filled with words. But if you ask around, most will tell you that in today's world, the image reigns. Even before the tremendous technological shifts that occurred in the latter part of the 20th century, images were everywhere. Books and magazines, billboards, television, t-shirts, and of course, indelibly etched on the bodies of tattoo aficionados. With the increasing influence of visual media like television and movies, the invention of the personal computer and its graphic user interface, and of course, the tectonic shifts that occurred with the advent of the internet, social media, and the arrival of smartphones with forward-facing cameras, it seems safe to say that we now live in an image-driven world. At the same time, though, some have argued that modern consciousness is shaped by an interesting ambivalence with respect to images. On the one hand, we act as though images have tremendous power and importance, using them to share our stories and shape our identities. Companies spend millions of dollars designing logos, and individuals spend even more making sure they look just right for whatever photo op might come their way. On the other hand, though, we think that our modern and scientific understanding of the universe has freed us from naively pre-modern views about the power of inanimate objects. We scoff at those who worship idols, and even look askance at those who venerate icons. We don't mind if children want to pretend that their toys have some kind of life and power of their own, but we fully expect mature humans to grow out of such simplistic ways of thinking as they come to understand how the world really works. Natalie Carnes describes our double consciousness with respect to images in this way. I'm quoting her here. We behave as if they are alive while claiming they are not. We act as though images can seduce, command, and persuade while insisting they have no agency. We then deny our duplicity by projecting the commitment to the aliveness of images onto some other, locating animism in childhood or far-off cultures or distant times, while claiming for ourselves a rationalism that knows these images not to be alive. At the same time, we build entire industries around the power of the image and fiercely contest its legislative circumscriptions and circulations. In other words, we somehow expect our images to be both powerful and powerless at the same time. This leaves us in a precarious position with respect to images in general. We accord them a place of power in our lives while simultaneously telling ourselves that they exert no real influence. Just consider what that would look like if we exercised that same logic in another sphere of life. In college, I remember thinking that it didn't really matter who you elected president, since all the real change took place at lower levels of government. The president might have all the trappings of power, I thought, but no real influence. Now, regardless of what you might think about such an opinion, one that I now regard to be rather foolish, it doesn't take too much to see how dangerous such a position might be. If we grant someone or something a position of power and influence, while simultaneously denying that they have any real power or influence, we set ourselves up to be shaped, manipulated, and even dominated without ever realizing what is taking place. I would argue that there is a similar ambivalence in many Christian communities about one particular image, the image of God. On the one hand, the Imago Dei has always played a central role in Christian doctrine, or Christian discourse about humanity, and I think most Christians would quickly and indeed loudly affirm that they think the image of God is important for what we think it means to be human. But at the same time, most of the churches with which I am familiar spend relatively little time discussing what they think the image of God actually means, and how their particular way of viewing the image shapes how they understand themselves and the way that we order the life of the church, beyond relatively generic and often vague claims about the image being that which grounds dignity and equality. So here as well, we have an image that we seem to treat as both powerful and powerless. We claim that it is of tremendous significance, but do little to consider how it might be influencing us. This is particularly problematic if we take seriously Calvin's claim that all theology involves the inseparable relationship between two things, knowledge of God and knowledge of ourselves. According to Calvin, everything we believe about God inevitably shapes what we believe about ourselves. Correspondingly, though, everything we believe about ourselves inevitably shapes what we believe about God. If so, then, the Imago Dei is uniquely positioned to have both positive and potentially devastating implications for what we believe about God and humanity, which covers a rather terrifyingly large swath of Christian doctrine. We could spend considerable time reflecting on the nature and function of images in our society in general and the implications of our apparent ambivalence toward them, but I want to focus our attention here on one issue in particular. That is, the fact that many of the images we use to convey what we think it means to be human seem almost necessarily to dehumanize by either excluding certain people from their image of humanity or by eliminating the concept of the human altogether. Now, I'm going to skip a bit here, otherwise we'll be here all night. And just let you know, I had a section that I want to just kind of reflect together on the power of images. And so I was going to talk a little bit about the prohibition on images and the Ten Commandments and do a little theological speculating on the possibility that the prohibition there isn't because the Bible thinks of images as necessarily bad, but because the Bible recognizes that images are inherently powerful. And so God prescribes limitations on the way that we use the image because of the recognition that in our broken state, we're likely to use images badly. And then I was going to reflect on the ways in which the image that I formed of myself as a child, by viewing the pictures that were taken of me as a kid or the images that I saw in the mirror, I grew up thinking of myself as the chubby kid. And that was an image that shaped my self-identity and stayed with me well into college, and in many ways stays with me even today. I didn't realize until I was about 23 or 24 that I'm actually average height and average weight. I always thought of myself as taller and heavier than everybody else around me. Years after that was no longer true. And that's the power of an image to shape reality. Right? That was the image that I had of myself contrary to the facts of the situation. And that's the kind of power that images have that I was going to have us reflect on that we're going to skip. All right. So the twofold problem of dehumanization, exclusion and elimination. Now, hopefully at least one of those vignettes that I skipped has primed us to think about the power images have for shaping us in fundamentally important ways. And the extra significance such images have when they represent things as important as God and ourselves, the latter of which is our focus for this evening. As we will see, though, the problem is that many, maybe even most of the images that shape our understanding of what it means to be human inevitably dehumanize in two important ways. Now, as far as we can tell, people have been using images to depict humanity pretty much as soon as we were able to make images of any kind. So we can kind of flip through images throughout history. We've always enjoyed crafting images that convey some conception of what it means to be human, what it means. I'm really curious about what that one says about what it means to be human, but I'll skip it. What it means to flourish as a human person. And of course, we have our own images that we use today. I'm not even going to attempt to do more than just kind of give a sampling of them, but we've got lots of them. Like, we're constantly looking at images that say something about what we think it means to be human or what it means to flourish as a human person in the world today. I'm not entirely certain what to do with that one. Now, granted, our modern societies are far more diverse than they used to be, and our technology for capturing and presenting images of humanity are far more advanced and widespread. So we use a far more diverse range of images to capture our concept of what it means to be human. And actually, I couldn't use many of the images that are the most common ways in which we cast a vision of humanity because they just wouldn't be terribly appropriate. Yet such images typically do more than merely depict what is. Instead, by choosing to focus on and celebrate some images of humanity more than and instead of others, we cast an essentially aesthetic vision of what humanity is and what it means for a human person to flourish in the world. In other words, such images have something to say about what is good in humanity, what is true about humanity, and what is beautiful in humanity. And here it is important to realize that we don't even need to be doing this intentionally. Just as I unintentionally internalized a certain conception of myself based on the images I thought I saw of myself when I was growing up, one that shaped my self-conception for years, so can our own images exercise a power over our anthropological imaginations far beyond what we intend or anticipate. By choosing to focus on and celebrate a certain set of images rather than some other set of images, we are casting a vision of the good, the true, and the beautiful. That sends a powerful, albeit often implicit, message that we cannot fail to internalize. If such images only affected our anthropological imaginations and self-conceptions, that alone would give them a power worth considering. But the truth runs deeper. The images we use to convey our conception of what is good, true, and beautiful about humanity also have the power to shape the very life and structure of our societies. Consider, for example, the ideal of the human as a well-rounded, well-educated person who can use their intellectual resources to make a meaningful contribution to society at large. This is an image that has been with us for a long time, coming in many ways from the classical world. And I would imagine that many of us are rather committed to this image. It's certainly one that not only forms my own self-identity, but also the many college visits I've gone on with my oldest daughter here recently. But this image drives far more than the self-conception of particular individuals or families. Because this image plays a prominent role in what we think of as the good, the true, and the beautiful about humanity, we are willing as a society to invest considerable effort into promoting that vision of humanity. Some of this becomes part of the formal structure of society. We pass laws requiring children to attend school. We tax the income, even of people who don't have children or who will never go to college. We give or loan tens of thousands of dollars to 18-year-olds, something we would view in other circumstances as bordering on insane. And we take level of education into account when hiring, even for jobs that do not directly require that kind of education. But we also promote this vision of humanity in less formal ways. Many of our movies and books highlight the significance of education for succeeding in the world. We often listen differently to people who speak as though they have an educational background, regardless of whether they actually do. And even just our basic assumptions about the kinds of things people should know and be able to do reveal the underlying structure of our society. In other words, we are constantly reinforcing and promoting this image, this vision of what it means to be and to flourish as a human person, through both the formal and informal structures of society, things that shape our very assumptions and everyday interactions. And I'm not trying to say there's anything wrong with this. Quite the opposite. If we do, in fact, have some vision of the good, the true, and the beautiful as it relates to being human, why wouldn't we invest considerable resources into promoting that vision so that human persons can flourish in the world? Indeed, it would be exceptionally weird to have some idea of what it means to flourish as a human person and not form our communities in such a way as to facilitate and promote that vision. Indeed, I'm not even entirely clear how a community can function apart from some conception of what it means to be human and how we should promote human flourishing. After all, every community has to make decisions about how to administer its resources, what kinds of activities to promote and behaviors to discourage. And even though we typically do not acknowledge this explicitly, those decisions are funded by some conception of what it means to be human and how to promote human flourishing in that community. It is important to realize, however, that this means there is an inseparable relationship between aesthetics, our vision of the good, the true, and the beautiful, between aesthetics, power, and privilege. I don't know why I did those separately. All right. In this context, power simply refers to the ability to get things done, to shape a course of action toward an intended result. So if we say that every aesthetic drives the way we construct our societies, both formally and informally, so that we can promote the vision of human flourishing contained in that aesthetic, then we are saying that every aesthetic promotes the use of societal power toward the end of achieving that vision of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And again, why wouldn't we do precisely this? If societies do have power, and they do in fact have considerable power, and if we do have some vision of what it is for human beings to flourish, then it would be irresponsible not to use that power for the sake of human flourishing. But this leads to the third link in our chain, privilege. Now, I realize that in some circles, the term privilege is contentious, sounding to many as though we are suggesting that privileged people enjoy an almost aristocratic position in society, which clearly does not resonate with the experiences of many of those to whom the label might apply. In this context, though, that's not what privilege means. Here, the term simply results from the reality I've been describing. Once a community has developed some vision of what it means to be human and has structured their society formally and informally, intentionally and unintentionally, according to that vision, it will inevitably be easier to navigate that community for people who fit within that vision of humanity. Take the educational example I offered earlier. It is far easier for me to navigate many of the communities in which I operate because I fit the community's aesthetic. I know the lingo. I can interpret the social cues. Okay, kind of. I look as though I belong. That doesn't mean any of these communities would intentionally exclude someone who comes from a different background, but the dynamics of aesthetics, power, and privilege does mean that it will inevitably be more difficult for someone who doesn't fit the community's aesthetic to make their way in that community. To see this, suppose that instead of living in suburban Chicago, my family and I decide to move to somewhere in rural Washington State. We love the outdoors, and maybe one of my theology books finally sold enough copies that we can afford to buy an outhouse in the woods and live off the royalties for the rest of our lives. But suppose as well that this community is one that operates with a different aesthetic, one shaped more around the vision of the survivor, the kind of person with the hard-earned and practical wisdom necessary for getting things done in the world. And in that community, such an aesthetic would also be promoted in both formal and informal ways. Formally, we might imagine that the schools teach certain subjects more often than in the schools I attended. The community might have a festival every summer, celebrating the skills valued in that vision of humanity. The kinds of people who get elected to public office would probably differ, along with the kinds of ordinances they enact. Informally, it would not be difficult to imagine that there might be differences in the kinds of things that families do together on the weekends, that parents would teach their children and expect them to be able to do certain kinds of things, and that what determines who is the popular kid in school might differ from where I was raised. In such a community, I would inevitably be an outsider, the other who just doesn't fit the community's aesthetic. My father never taught me to fish. If I ever went hunting, I guarantee the safest place for any animal would be directly in front of me. I think, build a table that might qualify as a table as long as you never put anything on it. And if I tell my wife I'm going to fix the car, I of course mean I'm driving it to the mechanic. Such a community would not be easy for me to navigate. Mine is no longer the privileged way of being human. And things that used to be relatively easy, like going to the store or chatting with a neighbor, might in many ways become awkward and difficult. I don't mean they'd be rude to me, possibly quite the opposite. They might even be much nicer to me than they are to each other. But that would not change the fact that in this context, I am an other, someone who doesn't fit their vision of what it means to be and flourish as a human person. And I will likely remain an outsider to at least some extent, no matter how long I live in that town, if I continue to exemplify a form of humanity that seems alien to that community's aesthetic. In other words, belonging to a community in this sense has less to do with where you were born or how long you've lived there than it does with the extent to which your form of humanity meshes with their own vision of what it means to be human. But all of this gets us to the problem of dehumanization. If our images of what it means to be human seek to portray, either implicitly or explicitly, some notion of the good, the true, and the beautiful, that necessarily seems to carry with it some corresponding idea of the bad, the false, and the ugly. Any vision of human flourishing stands in contrast to some concept of human perishing. Any concept of the human suggests some notion of the non-human, or at least the subhuman. And if our visions of humanity serve to inform a broader aesthetic that shapes the very structures of our society, then such images have the power to dehumanize in ways that affect the everyday experiences of real people in very real ways. Now, modern theorists have already identified many of the ways in which our most common images for humanity serve to exclude and dehumanize large segments of society. Traditionally in the West, we have tended to prioritize images of the male and masculine ideals, suggesting, sometimes actually stating, that the ideal for humanity is a masculine humanity, and that the only way for women to make progress toward this ultimate ideal is to become more masculine. Many of our images also cast a vision of humanity that celebrates youth and vigor in ways that raise questions for many about what this implies for those who are elderly or infirm. Others cast a vision of the truly flourishing human as one who is exceptionally strong, intelligent, and or productive, all of which raise questions for people working with those who experience various forms of disability, wondering if an anthropological aesthetic emphasizing such features of humanity truly has room to embrace the full humanity of these people as well. And we could continue almost ad nauseum. Every image we can set forth that would cast some vision of what it means to be human and to flourish as a human seems to carry with it the necessary consequence that it at least implies a question about the extent to which some people fully qualify as human according to that vision of humanity. Now, it's clearly not as though people have been completely unaware of this problem. Indeed, if you look closely at the images that we use most intentionally to establish the aesthetic that we think are most apt for casting the vision of humanity we want to celebrate, they are clearly seeking to address the problem. Rather than excluding certain ways of being human, they celebrate all of them. But this leads us to the second of two ways that we can run into the problem of dehumanization. If the first dehumanizes by excluding certain segments of society from the category of the full human, this approach runs the risk of eliminating the category of the human altogether. Can we really celebrate every conceivable expression of humanity without undermining the very idea that the concept human has any intelligible and identifiable content? Dealing specifically with the idea that we need to embrace all of the various sexual identities that can possibly be expressed by a human person as a legitimate form of human diversity, Pope Francis refers to this as the annihilation of man. In other words, this approach seems to resolve the exclusion problem by making the concept of the human so elastic that it's not entirely clear whether it can even survive as a meaningful concept. Now, some might object that I have misconstrued what these images are trying to portray. Maybe these diverse images should be understood such that each offers some small insight into the total picture of what it means to be human. In other words, maybe the concept of human is like a large mosaic in which each of these images of humanity portrays a distinct and legitimate piece. Consequently, rather than suggesting that each of these diverse expressions offers a different definition of humanity as a whole, suggesting that our vision of humanity needs to be completely malleable, we should instead view each as a partial expression of a more encompassing reality. It is not entirely clear to me how this would help us deal with the exclusion elimination problem, since it still leaves us with a decision about which pictures should be included in the mosaic. If we conclude that some images of humanity simply cannot be accommodated in any mosaic portraying the good, the true, and the beautiful about humanity, then we are still left with the implications of the exclusivist position. Yet if we try to avoid this by suggesting that any form of humanity should be included in our mosaic, then it seems that we necessarily end up with a vision of humanity that is again so elastic as to defy definition. In other words, even on the mosaic account, it seems that we are forced to choose between exclusivism and eliminationism in our account of humanity. So, the Imago Dei to the rescue. Now we need to turn our attention to the Imago Dei. After all, the very first thing the Bible says about what it means to be human is that we are made in the image of God, and that this is something that includes all humans, both male and female. This has long served as a central feature of Christian arguments for the intrinsic value of all human life and the necessity of treating every person with dignity. At the beginning of the Christian story about humanity, then, we have resources for developing a vision of humanity that avoids the problem of exclusion, since it includes all human persons, as well as the problem of elimination, since it defines humanity according to the Imago Dei. And if the situation were as simple as such an argument would suggest, we could all call it an evening right now and get to bed early. Unfortunately, though, there is a legitimate worry here that the Imago Dei actually makes things worse. Most of these other images of humanity that we've been considering only carry with them implicit visions of what it means to be human, and thus implicit worries about our two dehumanizing problems. After all, my guess is that very few communities intend to suggest that their vision of humanity excludes all others, even if their practices sometimes make it appear that way. And many embrace the ethos of diversity without thinking that they are thereby undermining the intelligibility of the concept human. But Christians typically appeal to the Imago Dei as offering an explicit statement about what it means to be human. And many worry that certain interpretations of the Imago Dei actually entail one of the two dehumanizing problems. If nothing else, we need to consider our own history with respect to the images we use to depict humanity, particularly those that relate to the Imago Dei. On the one hand, we have a long history of developing images that portray Adam and Eve before the fall, presumably when they were in a state in which they could best represent humanity, as it is supposed to be before the fall, in ways that seem merely to replicate the exclusivist worries mentioned earlier, young, attractive, Caucasian, and so forth. And then we turn the page to the New Testament and find a remarkably similar image in the young, hot, white Jesus that dominates so many of our pictures and movies. Just, I actually once did, I kind of looked at all of the actors who have portrayed Jesus in different movies, and it's just young, hot, white Jesus across the board. And then I looked at all the actors who have portrayed God in different movies, and they're fabulously diverse. And I'm still trying to work out the logic of that, why it is that one image seems so kind of consistently wedded to a particular way of conceiving humanity, and the other one's not, but that's for a different paper. This is particularly critical, given that Jesus is presented in the New Testament not only as fully human, but also as the one who is the true image of God, the sinless exemplar of what it means to be human. If this is the case, then we need to pay particular attention to our images of Jesus and guard against the tendency to baptize our preferred anthropological aesthetic by casting Jesus in our own image, rather than allowing him to shape our understanding of what it means to be human. The history of the Imago Dei itself fares little better. As John Kilner has recently reminded us, despite the long tradition of using the image to affirm the unique dignity of human persons, Christians also have a long history of using the Imago Dei to dehumanize certain segments of society. We have at various times implicitly or explicitly argued that women, people with disabilities, particularly mental disabilities, Native Americans, and African Americans, among others, are not fully or even at all in the image of God. So our own history will not allow us to make any simple appeal to the Imago Dei as a way of responding to the problem of dehumanization. Instead, we will at least need to provide some explanation for why we think these historical instances are actually examples of misusing the image, and why the image, once properly understood, helps us avoid dehumanization. Yet we have a problem here as well. Kilner, along with many others, argues that the dehumanizing application of the Imago Dei is a direct result of how most Christians have interpreted the image throughout history. That is, as some capacity or set of capacities that both makes us like God and unlike other creatures. Although the texts themselves do not offer any definition of the image, it does present the image as something that is only true of human persons, and the logic of an image, so the argument goes, requires that it identifies something about the human person that mirrors or reflects God's attributes in creation in some way. Any number of attributes have been suggested as offering legitimate candidates for being the kinds of attributes this might involve, including our capacities for rationality, morality, freedom, relationality, creativity, speech, and so forth. And again, such an interpretation can identify the image with one of those capacities in particular, as has often been done with rationality, or it might contend that the whole set of uniquely human capacities constitutes the Imago Dei. The logic remains the same either way. Despite the prevalence of this way of interpreting the image, modern scholarship has offered quite a range of criticisms that would be worth considering if our focus was on the adequacy of this view in general. The specific issue that involves us here, though, has to do with the idea that defining the image in terms of capacity exposes itself to concerns about the fact that people express those capacities to greater or lesser degrees, and in some extreme cases may not express the relevant capacity at all. Yet this suggests that we have to view capacities as the kinds of things that can be placed on a scale from higher to lower, resulting in a hierarchical understanding of the image. Some people are more in the image than others. Given the centrality of the image in Christian conceptions of what it means to be human, the consequence seems to be that some people are more or less human than others. And if the scale runs all the way from expressing that capacity to the maximal extent possible for a human, traditionally associated with Jesus, humans in the eschatological realm, and maybe Adam and Eve, all the way down to those who do not express the capacity at all, for example, someone with a significant head trauma, then we now have a framework not only for declaring someone to be less human than others, but even for identifying certain groups as entirely non-human, despite the fact that they would seem to qualify as human according to other traditional ways of determining humanity, for example, having human parents. Kilner thus concludes that the problem lies in the very notion that, quote, being in God's image is about the degree to which people line up in some sort of traits, capabilities scale. Now, to be fair to the position Kilner's critiquing here, however, we need to recognize that there is some slippage in his argument from the idea of having a capacity to that of manifesting the capacity. The traditional way of understanding how capacities relate to the image of God is to contend that having the relevant capacity or set of capacities is what constitutes the Imago Dei, irrespective of whether or not we are actually exercising or manifesting that capacity in any meaningful way. On such an account, even someone with significant head trauma or a severe intellectual disability would still qualify as fully in the image of God, and thus fully human, since they still possessed the capacity for rationality, despite the fact that the condition of their body is preventing that capacity from becoming fully or even partially actualized right now. In other words, having the relevant capacity is essential for being human, but the extent to which that capacity does or does not manifest itself in any particular human individual is just one of the many ways in which humans differ from one another. If that's the case, then Kilner's argument misfires. While it would remain the case that this view of the image has a long-standing historical relationship to various dehumanizing applications of the Imago Dei, these would only result from the fact that the capacity view might be susceptible to a particularly nefarious kind of misunderstanding. Even with this more nuanced understanding of the capacity view, though, I think there's still room for concern. First, we should at least recognize that this approach requires an ontology of the human person in which the relevant capacities are grounded in something other than the body, presumably the soul. That is what allows such a position to maintain that a person can possess the capacity for X, even if their ability to manifest X has been affected by some bodily impairment. Yet an increasing number of Christians now operate with an ontology of the human person that is much more holistic or even physicalistic, in which it becomes difficult to conceptualize what it would even mean to say that a human person has capacities that somehow exist independently of the condition of the body. Those who remain committed to some form of substance dualism will be untroubled by these worries, but it's worth recognizing that Kilner's concerns will reassert themselves if we attempt to wed a capacity view of the image to any physicalist or even largely holist understanding of the human person. My more fundamental worry, though, is whether such a view has really taken seriously the possibility that it bears some responsibility for the history of dehumanization we noted earlier. Even if we contend that this history is a result of misinterpretation, should we not ask whether the consistency with which people living in diverse times and places have arrived at the same misinterpretation with the same devastating implications for important segments of society? Granted, we cannot simply dismiss an idea simply because humans have been consistently bad at understanding it. We are also consistently bad at loving our neighbors, and that doesn't mean we should stop trying. But if some theological notion is consistently linked with a negative ramification, particularly one as negative as this one appears to be, it would be irresponsible not to consider other options. Even more, the history of oppression and dehumanization that has plagued the capacity view would seem to place the burden of proof on anyone who wants to maintain this as the correct way of understanding the image moving forward. If we have other viable interpretations of the image that can avoid these problematic implications, we should pursue them with all rigor. Problem, though, notice I'm using a, every time I start a new paragraph, it's the problem, though, my Mark Twain story is unfolding. The problem, though, is that many of the other interpretations of the image seem to struggle with precisely the same implications. Speaking in very general terms, if the various capacity views all think of the Imago Dei as denoting something about what humans are, the other two major families of interpretations focus instead on the image as something humans are called to do, functional view, or as something about who humans are, relational view. Taking the functional view first, here we shift the emphasis from the intrinsic capacities of the human person and focus instead on the idea that the image of God is more like a vocation or calling. Humans image God insofar as they carry out some task in the world, typically associated with the language of rulership or dominion. The problem here is that any such view seems to exclude certain humans even more obviously than the capacity view. No matter what activity we might name, it would not be difficult to think of certain groups of humans who are unable to perform the requisite activity. Some have argued that we might circumvent the problem by proposing a more corporate understanding of the Imago Dei, in which the relevant function is something performed by the entire people of God, and not by any particular individual alone. So even if I got in a car accident and ended up in a coma, we could still say that I am participating in the function of the Imago Dei insofar as I am still a member of the human community, and the community as a whole is carrying out that function. But such an argument runs into the problem that we have at least two biblical texts that seem to think that the Imago Dei is something that applies to particular individuals and not merely to humanity as a whole. That's the Genesis 9, don't kill people, and the James 3, be mindful how you speak to people, seems to have kind of an ethical implication at the individual level. Additionally, I find it hard to believe that such an argument is not just as susceptible to misunderstanding and misapplication as the capacity view. It seems entirely too easy to notice that certain human persons obviously aren't participating to the same extent as other humans, and to draw the relevant conclusions regarding the status of their humanity. If defining the image in terms of what humans are or what they do both generate the same kinds of problems, then maybe the solution resides in focusing instead on the fact that God clearly created humans to be in relationship with him and with each other. So maybe the image just is about these relationships, and being in relationship seems to be the kind of thing that is unavoidably true for all humans, irrespective of what capacities they have or what functions they perform. Even in a comatose state, I would still be son of my parents, wife of my spouse, father of my children, brother of my brother, sibling of my brother, there we go, and so forth. Consequently, many contend that the relational view is uniquely positioned to avoid the exclusion worry altogether. Nonetheless, problems arise as soon as we begin to ask more about what we mean by the term relational. Many contend that such language is really just a disguise for what is ultimately either a capacity, relationality, or a function, relating, which would mean that the relational view is not a distinct view of the image after all and is subject to the same concerns raised above. To avoid this, the relational view needs a more abstract understanding of a relation, something that can obtain irrespective of capacities or functions. But if we go this way, it's not clear precisely what it is that would make these relationships distinctively human. I am also in some kind of relationship with this room, my shoes, and sadly enough, my wife's cat. Unless we want to call those imago Dei kinds of relationships, we need some way of identifying which kinds of relationships qualify and which do not. But the most viable ways of differentiating kinds of relationships involve appealing to the very kinds of capacities and activities that the relational view is trying to distinguish itself from. In these quick surveys, I'm obviously not trying to offer comprehensive critiques of these various ways of viewing the image. But this should suffice to illustrate the challenges faced by many of the more common interpretations of the Imago Dei when it comes to dealing with the exclusion problem. In their own way, each ends up talking about humanity in ways that could easily call into question, and some people think essentially entail calling into question, the extent to which at least some humans qualify as fully and truly human. But what if we argued instead that the problem lies in thinking that the image of God is the kind of thing that can and should be explained in the first place? Maybe we should learn something from the endless debate surrounding the meaning of Genesis 1, 26 to 28, and realize that the Imago Dei is the kind of thing that transcends our ability to understand. It's just a mystery. If humans were created to image a mysterious and transcendent God, should it really come as a surprise to discover that humans themselves are ultimately mysterious and transcendent? And if this is the case, then the Imago Dei transcends any capacity or function, thus eliminating any possible worries about excluding certain humans. Now, although appeals to mystery are becoming increasingly common in interpretations of the Imago Dei, we need to recognize that such an interpretation solves the exclusion problem at the expense of generating the elimination problem. If the concept of the Imago Dei has no content beyond mystery, it becomes very easy to end up with a concept of the human that is, again, infinitely open, which is to say that it is not much of a concept at all. So what do we do? What are we to do if the Imago Dei itself seems to carry with it the very problem of dehumanization that we were seeking to avoid? Well, we have some options. First, we could just conclude that either or both of the two dehumanization problems we've been discussing, the exclusion and elimination problems, are not really problems. In other words, we could just argue that it's perfectly legitimate to exclude certain people from the category human, or maintain that there's nothing wrong with affirming that the concept human has no determinable meaning. I've not really argued that we should view those as problems, using them instead as the assumed starting point for the discussion. In the Q&A, maybe someone can convince us that these really aren't problems after all, and we can move happily forward. Alternatively, maybe we need to rethink the relationship between humanity and image of God. Although it is quite common today for people to maintain all humans are in the image of God, that has not necessarily been the case throughout history. For example, those who argue that the image was completely lost at the fall and is only restored in redemption, maintain at least some distinction between the image and humanity, insofar as they continue to think of fallen humans as legitimately human. If we allow for this kind of distinction, then we would have the resources for having an exclusivist understanding of the Imago Dei without raising any corresponding worries about an exclusivist understanding of humanity. The problem here, though, is that the entire reason for turning to the Imago Dei in this argument was to address the problem of dehumanization in general. So this approach merely admits that the Imago Dei has all the same problems as any other vision of humanity with respect to the exclusion and elimination concerns and walks away. A third option might be to draw more heavily on a teleological or eschatological conception of the image, things that came up in our discussions this morning. Maybe the problem is that the summaries of the various views I offered earlier focused too much on the state of humanity now in all its frailties and failures. But if we focused more on the eschatological fulfillment of God's purposes for the Imago Dei, then we could include capacities and functions without fear of excluding anyone based on their current limitations. To do this, though, we would need to be careful that we did not, again, simply reintroduce the elimination worry. I think most would affirm that theological anthropology needs to be informed by some vision of the eschaton, but it would be very easy for such an argument to once again result in the elimination of any real concept of what it means to be human. And although we're nearing the end of the time allotted for this paper and cannot address this completely, we also need to be aware that quite a number of those dealing with the theology of disability object to the notion that all impairments will be healed in the resurrection, raising a question of whether we should just assume that reorienting anthropology around eschatology would automatically result in solving all the worries that arise from views of the image based in capacities and or functions. I look forward to exploring these possibilities in our discussion, as well as any others you may want to propose. But I think a better way forward is to reframe how we think about the Imago Dei itself. And in this section, I'm going to re-summarize some material from my earlier paper, so those of you who are here this morning can go into daydream mode for a little bit. Each of the various positions we have considered assumes that the Imago Dei focuses primarily on some characteristic of humanity. It is something we are, something we do, some way in which we relate. And this creates the challenge of defining the image in such a way that it has enough content to be meaningful, but not so much content that it excludes certain people. But what if the Imago Dei is actually more of a statement about something God does than it is about anything human persons are or do? Drawing on the work of quite a number of Old Testament scholars, I have argued elsewhere, i.e. earlier today, that the most natural way of hearing the language of image and likeness in Genesis 1 is against the backdrop of what ancient Near Eastern peoples thought about idols. Tselem, or image, in particular, was routinely used to refer to these cultic images. And many have argued that this would have been the assumed meaning of the term in Genesis 1. Without going into detail, the basic idea of an idol is that it was the physical means by which some divine being manifested his or her presence in the world. Despite some biblical rhetoric to the contrary, ancient people were well aware that an idol was more than just a statue, a thing fashioned from wood or stone by human hands. Instead, they saw the idol as an object into which some divine being had infused its own spirit, such that the idol had become the means by which the divine being is present in the world. If this is the appropriate background against which to understand the language of image and likeness in Genesis 1, it does not seem too much of a stretch to think that the ancient Israelites would have understood this to be saying that God has created human persons to be the creaturely entities into which he would breathe his own divine spirit, such that they would come alive and be the means by which he would manifest his own glorious presence in creation. If so, and here is where this interpretation matters for the purposes of this argument, it is important to see that the Imago Dei is therefore fundamentally a truth about something that God does. He manifests his presence in and through us, in us through the Spirit. And that this does not depend in any way on our capacities or functions. The capacities of the statue are not what make it an idol. And if there is any function involved, it is one that God performs by using a creaturely medium to manifest divine presence in the world. And if the statue's status as an idol is not contingent upon any property possessed by the statue or function performed by the statue, then no impairment of either can render it no longer an idol. The only way for an idol to stop being an idol is through the withdrawal of divine presence again at the initiative of the God who gifted it in the first place. If we extend this logic to the Imago Dei, we end up with a similar conclusion regarding the relationship between human capacities and functions to the image of God. All humans are endowed with some set of capacities. And insofar as they are living beings, they are carrying out some functions. But these are not what constitute the image. God alone constitutes us as his image bearers in and through the power of the Spirit. And we in turn are called to utilize whatever capacities we might have and to carry out the corresponding functions to whatever extent we are able as we seek to live in response to the prior reality of the divine initiative that we see in the Imago Dei. This clearly avoids the elimination worry, since it actually has quite a bit to say about what it means to be human, while still allowing considerable latitude for diverse expressions of humanity and the various kinds of capacities we do and do not manifest. And it provides resources for avoiding the worry that the Imago Dei entails the exclusion of certain humans. So at the very least, it would seem that such an approach can stave off the worry that the Imago Dei leaves us worse off with respect to other visions of humanity when it comes to the problems of dehumanization. However, lest we become complacent in thinking we have accomplished more than we have, none of this avoids the worries about exclusion entirely. The fact remains that this way of understanding the Imago Dei should also lead to some conception of what it means to flourish as a human person. The practices we need to inhabit in order to promote that flourishing, and how our communities should be ordered so as to sustain those practices, all of which will inevitably result in the application of some form of power, which again just means getting things done, and privilege, which again just means promoting this vision of human flourishing. But when sinful and broken people begin exercising power and privilege in the pursuit of even a good goal, particularly in a context when we are always already shaped by countless other visions of what it means to be human, we almost inevitably end up marginalizing and excluding, despite our best efforts to the contrary. So I offer this reflection on the Imago Dei as no more than, though hopefully no less than, an important theological contribution to what must be a sustained dialogue about how we as Christians can promote and sustain our vision of human flourishing while seeking in all faithfulness to avoid dehumanizing God's image bearers. Thank you.
Got a few minutes for questions, so if you have a question, please come to the microphone and ask it of Dr. Cortez, and I'll let him field them himself.
When we talk about the image of God, as Christians, we think about the triune God. So I have, and of course, in the early church, there was a concept of the vestige of the Trinity in creation. Could that work into the image of God? Because sometimes it gets into a monotheism of some undifferentiated unity, and then we want to push everything into that that image instead of a God that is interrelated in triune unity.
Yeah, so I'm going to go in a couple different directions with that. One, we need to talk a little bit more about what things we have in mind with the vestiges of the Trinity. Insofar as we think in terms of like kind of God's attributes being manifested in us in some way, and if we see those attributes as constituting the image of God, then yeah, that's precisely the kind of capacity that would result in the same kind of capacity view that I'm nervous about. You can do it though. When I've had to explain this enough times that you'd think I would have put this in the paper. What I have said about not wanting to ground the image of God in capacities doesn't mean that I don't think that we should try to imitate God. Right, that we should seek to exemplify and pattern ourselves after God. We've got lots of language in the Bible, right, about being shaped by who God is, be holy as I am holy, and all of those kinds of things. And I want to affirm all of that. I just don't think any of it constitutes what the image is. They're all things that we do in response to the prior reality of God having already constituted us as his image. So whenever the conversation begins to flow in the other direction, so that there's something that has to be true of me or something that I have to do or whatnot in order for me to be image, then I kind of fall back into the worries that I'm trying to tease out in the paper. If the order goes the other direction, God constitutes me as an image bearer and then calls me to live faithfully in light of the fact that I'm an image bearer, which includes seeking to be holy as he is holy and to love as he loves and all of those kinds of things, then I have no problem with it whatsoever. Oh, stepping back over here. I said important things. I don't stand at podiums well, so I don't have a paper to keep me connected to the podium. Yeah, all right.
It seems to me that as Christians, you know, we'll always have views of reality that the rest of the world won't buy into necessarily. But just thinking biblically about what it means to be human on a simple level, it seems to me that to be a descendant of the first human beings is what makes us a human. And that the real issue is, what's the image of God? I mean, that seems to be the real question. Whether we reflect it this way, that way, or another way, if we are, in fact, descendants of the first people he created, we can't exclude anybody from that. We are human. But what does that mean? Well, that has to do with unpacking the image of God. And I was thinking about the issue of those who would disqualify people from being human. Biblically, I think what the Bible does present, there are people who act inhuman as opposed to non-human. Antichrist being an example of the beast, or in some of the Psalms when it talks about how people act like adders, they act like this, they act like that, but they're still human.
Yeah, I keep saying I'm looking forward to discussing post-humanism tomorrow, because I do wonder, so the traditional view has always been descent is what identifies a human as a human. So insofar as we're descended from Adam and Eve, we're good to go.
And that's why I said the world will have a view as Christians or as people who believe in the word that
would
be different than the world.
Right. Although we're already operating in a scientific context in which that conversation's gotten a little bit more complicated. So anybody who is willing to talk about the origin of humanity from an evolutionary perspective already has a descent challenge involved there, because descent gets complicated once you start talking in those kinds of terms. I'm curious to see in 25 or 30 years, as technology advances with respect to reproduction, if the descent conversation is going to get complicated on that end as well, because we're going to have forms of reproduction that don't naturally fit into what we typically talk about in descent terms. So that's a long-standing resource that I'm just wondering if that's going to get messy in ways that we're not yet thinking about.
And my last comment was just that it seems to me that the image of God is where the church needs to be thinking about how to address the issues of gay rights, gay marriage, transgenderism, as opposed to know that's bad, to have a much more profound argument about what it is to be made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm. That's my worry. Like, if we say that images are powerful and they shape us, and they possibly shape us even more when we're not talking about them and thinking about them, if that's right, if my experience in my Christian communities is at all reflective of what's going on in the churches more broadly speaking, that's happening with the image, right? It is, in fact, shaping us, but we're not talking about it. We're not kind of really reflecting on it and asking the question of what do we think this thing is and how is it shaping us? So, yeah, totally agree.
Going to the how you're talking about the image bearing with idols and the ancient Near East view that God would fill that. And I appreciate your critical scholarship a lot. It sounds like we're at an embodied spirit then. Is that where you would?
It depends on what exactly you mean by that. So the way that I understand the image with the kind of the idea that God infuses his spirit to manifest his presence in the world in and through us, I don't think that you have to have a particular ontology of the human person to make that work. You could be a dualist or a physicalist. So Irenaeus, who I talked about this morning, he's going to have body, soul, and Holy Spirit kind of constituting the human person. But there's absolutely nothing to prevent a Christian physicalist from saying that the human person is a complex material reality and the Holy Spirit infusing and indwelling that. I think it works either way.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Uh-huh.
Can you make a comment on the contribution of the cross to understanding the image of God and how Christian theology has perhaps understood that?
Can you tease that out a little more?
I guess, at the cross, the Lord Jesus was fully human, but completely dependent at that moment of death. My God, why have you forsaken me? Thinking of the new humanity and perhaps the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the meek. Is there any discussion about those factors that contribute to the image of God?
Yeah, probably more than I realized, that the literature where I've seen that engaged most kind of robustly are the theologians that I've mentioned who are engaged in theologies of disability. And the cross and then Paul dealing with his own weakness are often places where they go to say that we have misconceived the vision of humanity that the Bible is actually trying to give us when we celebrate as our kind of primary constitutive vision things like youth and strength and vigor and ability and whatnot. And that's actually not primarily the vision that we would get if we led with things like the cross as being central to our understanding of who Jesus is, and then if Jesus is the true image of God, our understanding of what the image is, and then how that shapes our own identities. And that's, I just briefly mentioned that they then also ask questions about the way that we characterize humanity in the eschaton. If we're going to kind of lead with that as reshaping, kind of an anthropology of weakness would be language that they would be comfortable with, rather than kind of an anthropology based on strength. That we wouldn't want to then subvert that by having an eschatological vision of humanity that simply re-inscribes a vision of humanity that's all about strength and ability and power and whatnot. And they're saying, no, Jesus still has the marks on his body, and that we are still needy and dependent creatures, and an anthropology of weakness might be a more fit category even for eschatological anthropology. Yeah. And someone is behind me or next to me. Yeah.
Let's thank Mark for his presentation. If you have more questions or would like him to sign one of the books, you can purchase.